You probably know Jeffrey Tambor from the unforgettable characters he's played. Hank Kingsley on The Larry Sanders Show, twin brothers George and Oscar Bluth on Arrested Development, and most recently his Emmy and Golden Globe winning role as Maura Pfefferman?
Maura, yeah.
On Transparent. In a new memoir, and you're going to have to give me a line read on this as well, Are You Anybody? How would you say it?
Well, the way it was said to me at the 44th Street Theater, the Broadhurst Theater, was just he looked at me, the autograph seeker, and he said, Are you anybody?
In a new memoir called Are You Anybody? He writes about his life on and off television, including his childhood, the 10 years he crossed the country doing repertory theater, and working with mentors like Gary Shandling. His book is published by Crown Archetype, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jeffrey Tambor to our show now.
I'm so honored to be here. I listen to you every day.
Oh,
and so,
thank you.
And you look exactly, if I were to play you, I would look like you.
Really?
Yeah, I would do the beard and the eyebrows and everything. You look exactly like Leonard Lopate.
Well, for good reason.
Oh.
You preface your book with a series of personal letters that were written to friends and agents, essentially saying that you couldn't possibly write a memoir. So what changed your mind?
Well, first of all, those are faux letters, and it sort of bespeaks my sort of trepidation of entering this field. I grew up I own a bookstore in
Los Angeles,
Skylight Books, and I've grown up in public libraries and bookstores all my life, and the theater. And I just met Scott Turow in the lobby, and I threw myself at him.
Well, he told me when he was here that you appeared in one of the films based on his books.
Right. I think it was Presumed Innocent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The first.
Did he say how good I was, or did he anything?
He said he had great fondness for you.
Oh, okay. That's another way of saying he can't remember. Okay, great. I have a great regard for authors, and I don't take it lightly. So that was my faux introduction as I trepidatiously enter this field.
And how did you wind up co-owning a bookstore?
It's been a dream of mine all my life. In the book, I actually write about a bookstore owner who did change my life and who did give me the reading of books. And I said, someday I will. And I don't know what it is about bookstores and the theater. There is that communication, and I don't want to sound all, yucky and futzy, but I think it's all about connection, and I like bookstores, and I like watching people buy books. It's not in terms of entrepreneurship. There are other aspects you can go into to make a buck.
As they say, yeah. If you want to make a small fortune in a bookstore business, yes. Start off with a large fortune.
that's right. But it pleases me, and I do love books, and I do support authors. And I must tell you, it's quite interesting to introduce an author, and I'm all about that.
And does the selection of books reflect your interests, or do you just try to be as general as possible?
Well, here's the irony of this whole venture is that on purchasing the bookstore with a couple of other people, I then moved to New York. So I own a bookstore in Los Angeles. I live in New York. So what I am basically, I get to go on radio shows and say I'm a co-owner of a bookstore.
Now, actors often tell me that they like being in New York partly because people leave them alone when they recognize them. But you write that it's not uncommon for people to mistake you for Dr. Phil.
I get Dr. Phil.
Larry David.
Larry
and thank
David.
You for all the good
yes.
that you're doing.
Right.
The title of the book suggests that they're not the only ones who are confused. Why do you think that is? Your face is quite distinctive.
Well, you think?
On top of it all, you've been on a number of really big hit shows.
Yeah.
You've starred in a few of them.
Right.
I would have thought by now everybody would know who you are.
Well, gosh, thank you. You sound like my mother and father put together. My God. When I was playing Hank and I was a little heavier,
By the way, that was the only show about a talk show that I have ever seen that
yeah.
I thought really got it right.
And it's somewhat similar to the backstage here. Is that right?
Well, a little less turgid here, but
yes.
Yeah. We're not television.
Well, but it's less turgid. I mean, in fact, when you get off the elevator, you feel it. It's so less turgid
yeah.
in here.
I don't flirt with the guests.
I don't flirt with the guests. Did my character flirt with the guest?
No. But Larry's character did.
Yeah. He was after something that I thought was very interesting. He was after that line between celebrity and whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And he had a deeper purpose there. He changed my life, basically.
You called him one of your mentors, even though you'd had quite a bit of experience before you wound up working with
him. Well, here's the deal. Here's what he taught, and it's in the book. He taught me what I already, quote, knew, unquote. In other words, I always thought comedy was done that way, but was told that it isn't done that way. And he was all about mistakes. He was about spur of the moment, in the moment, doing it badly. And when I saw him on his show, it's a Gary Shandling show. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Sure.
I pointed
before
out,
you
I
worked
said,
with him.
Whatever he's doing, I would like to do that. It's and of course the great Jill Soloway is like that. It's how we do Transparent, Mitch Hurwitz and Arrested Development, and this trifecta that I'm on spurred the book. And I wanted my kids don't know why I wrote this book. Is my kids do not know what I do for a living.
Really?
Well, they think I eat lunch because I go to the they come to the set and we eat lunch, and so they tell their friends my dad eats lunch, which is. So I said, I better.
And they never see you on television?
Well, here's the deal. They do, but I have different guises. Once I'll be Mora. I'm now the voice of a burrito. Mm-hmm. On television. I'm many places. So they're kind of going, what's going on here?
I heard that your kids think that you're either Dr. Phil or Larry David.
They do not.
Oh, my guest is Jeffrey Tambor. He has written a memoir called Are You Anybody? It is published by Crown Archetype. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're right that laughter is Darwinism. It's for survival. It's mm-hmm. for health. Mm-hmm. How did humor help you when you were growing up?
Well, I came from less than the Tambors of Westlake in San Francisco were less than warm and fuzzy. They tried their best. And as I say in the book, you know what's interesting is that this is the first time in my life that I've used that phrase, as I say in the book. Because I've never written a book, and it's fun to say, as I say in the book. You know, it was done to actually give me a little time. So I realized if I made somebody laugh, I had a little more think time. And then I developed a, if you will, a gift for it. And then so I decided to make use of it.
Plus, but not as a comic.
No. What do you mean?
Well, you could have done stand-up comedy if you
wanted
to.
No, I could never have done. I can't. I know one joke, and it can't be said on the air.
Thank you for not saying.
You're right. The punchline is I can't do both. and so I enjoy humor. I think humor is a teaching instrument. I think there's if there is a higher power, it is in that area. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You say as a kid that you loved watching.
You know, I'm looking at you and I'm saying, you must have looked across this desk and seen every schmo that's ever walked through here.
I've seen some pretty great schmoes.
And, yeah? Would you consider me...
And you're, we've given you a fair amount of time because we think you're one of the better schmoes.
Okay. More time than, let's say, Dr. Phil?
Has Dr. Yeah, I think you know, Dr. I was on Phil his has show? Never been a guest on the show.
All right.
So I guess we're not going to talk about it. But anyway, we have had Steve Allen, who you said was one of your heroes.
I worshipped him.
And you say you also love Jack Parr. Worshipped Oscar Levant, him. Who was a very different kind of comic.
Dark.
Mind.
Dark.
Jack Benny. Did they all teach you how to appreciate delivering comic lines?
What they did was when Jack Benny would do his look, you remember that around him was, mm-hmm. were the Mel Blanks and the, what was the heavy, Don somebody, the very heavy
yes,
set.
Yes, I do yes. know who you
and,
mean.
And they were all just doing their shenanigans, and he would just kill with that one look. And I said, well, that must be the way. And there's a wonderful, wonderful theory or adage in acting is don't put a hat on a hat, which was taught to me by my mentor, Jack Cook at San Francisco State. My tuition was $48, by the way.
Uh-huh.
What do you mean, uh-huh?
Well, I went to Brooklyn College. I probably didn't even pay that much, but those were the good old days, Jeffrey.
$48. You can't go to Starbucks.
Yeah.
And so he said, you don't put a hat on a hat. And it sort of stayed with me.
Now, what does that mean exactly?
Well, you don't overdo it. You do less is more.
How did your parents react when you told them you're going to be on The Tonight Show someday?
My father, actually, he was a boxer, and he had a boxing ring. And he went, oh, Beppy. That was what they called me because I couldn't pronounce my name. And he hit me on the head with the ring, and it made me cry. And I remember saying that I would show him. Cut to, years later, being introduced on The Tonight Show, and I remember saying that.
Did he see you on that show?
No, but he did see me on Broadway with George C. Scott and Sly Fox. He came downstairs to congratulate me. He opened his mouth, and there were his upper teeth were gone, because he had on the plane he tried to open the peanuts with his teeth, and his congratulations, his Mazel Tov had no teeth in it.
And that was a shocker to you too.
Well, here it is, and he saw me in Injustice for All. With Al Pacino. So I think the nervous Jewish father got over that.
But you had aspirations from the start. You also practiced signing autographs.
Yes, best wishes.
You hosted being a guest on your own talk show when
yes,
you were a kid.
I'm surprised. I would do my little talk show in the basement, and I would play all the guests. Plus, I would also do this laughter. It sounded like this. And I'm surprised they didn't have an exorcism. They were very worried about me.
By the way, a listener called in from New Mexico.
Oh, I'm big in New Mexico.
To say that she would never mistake you for Dr. Phil, and that she's always found you one of the sexiest men alive.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, New Mexico. Mm. Wow.
Well, you know, there's not much happening in Alamogordo these days.
Well done. Well done.
Is it true that your father cried when you started to lose your hair when you were 17?
Yes, I came back from summer stock. I was, I think, 16 or 17. I put all that hair whitener in my hair, and he got very upset. Of course, my father was just this Hungarian Jewish guy who just, you know, he was... He didn't smile very much. He was sort of, I don't know. He was a great, great guy, but he thought it was his fault.
Were they supportive of your decision or your desire to go into theater and acting?
This is why they invented this phrase. they were so-so. I mean, I think they didn't quite understand it, but there was nothing you could do. And for you mothers and fathers out there who have kids, there's nothing you can do, so just forget about it.
Every character you've played has been Jewish, but you describe your family as the only Jewish family for miles in San Francisco, and people who were desperate to assimilate.
Hmm. I actually played the Bishop of Beauvais in St. Jones, and he wasn't Jewish, but that was in repertory theater.
But he wore a yarmulke, didn't
he? But if I play him, he was Jewish. what was your question?
I forgot.
Me too.
Now, you said your parents were desperate to assimilate.
Yeah, they were in that generation. That was very, very – that was that generation who tried to get along, I was the only Jew within miles. I tell about
really?
It.
Really? There are a lot of Jews in San Francisco.
There
San
are,
Francisco
but not
now.
In where we were in Daly City. And I remember being sent home. I went on a play date and being sent home because the mother of the – this is in the book. I was sent home, and I said to the girl, why? Why do I have to go home? She goes, my mother said your people killed Christ. That was an interesting walk home.
And you didn't have a response?
I had no response. No. I tell you the response I got, and I'll never forget.
You know, Lenny Bruce had a bit about that. His Uncle Marty, he said, my Uncle Marty did it, not me.
I used to go and study Lenny Bruce when I was in San Francisco. I grew up in San Francisco at the Hungry Eye. That was my college, my college away from college.
But then after college in San Francisco, you decided to attend graduate school at Wayne State University in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than one of the many prestigious schools in California where you could have studied acting?
Oh, well, I was I don't think I was invited to the many prestigious schools, and nor did I think there were any. I wanted to go to either the Guthrie Theater or this one. This had an active repertory theater, and thank God I went to Wayne State University, because we put those shows up on their feet with some of the greatest actors going, and boy, do you learn on your feet.
Who were you doing it with?
You mean you want names?
Yeah, at that time, you,
there
kid.
Was James Barton Hill. There was you're not going to know any of these names. James Barton Hill, by the way, is in my book. He read my palm. He was sort of a savant. He played Cassius in Julius Caesar. I played Julius Caesar. And he read my palm, and he said, oh, you're going to be very successful, but it's going to come to you very late. He didn't tell me how late.
You still remember the first review you ever received for Caliban and the Tempest.
Yes, it was by Jay Carr in the Detroit News. I had a beaded costume. It was green. Plus, I was so actory. I put green chlorophyll gum. I would chew it just before I went on, so I would dart my tongue out with my green tongue. And the review was, Jeffrey Tambor's Caliban is a beaded bag gone wrong.
Ooh, that's
Ouch.
Not a good review.
No. That's crying for 2 days.
Many actors tell me that they prefer not to read the reviews, good or bad.
Yeah, but there's no way, because now people tell you. They go, or if you're backstage and you're making up, you get, yeah. And people come in and say, are you okay? I love your work. Oh, I'm so sorry. And then a number of, I just want you to know that you're one of the finest actors. Yeah. All right. Will you be all right? And by the time you get to curtain, you want to kill yourself.
But didn't you meet your future TV wife, Judith Leigh, who plays Shelley Pfefferman on Transparent?
Yes. And good segue.
And Milwaukee Rep.
Yes, we did. And we are at the YM, 92nd Street Y tonight. Are you coming? And she and I are in concert, and we will be talking about her book. Please come over.
Okay. So you're her book and your book?
She didn't have a book. She's just helping me on my book. And yes, and I've known Judith, well, she doesn't want to tell me, for, I can't say, on the air 40 years.
Where you met in Milwaukee.
Right? Milwaukee. And
when you were both starting out and learning your trade.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey Tambor is here to talk about his first book, a memoir called Are You Anybody? It is published by Crown Archetype, and we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Jeffrey Tambor. He has written a memoir called Are You Anybody? It is published by Crown Archetype. When did your early career in repertory theater, what did it teach you about acting?
Well, you're on your feet, and your theory goes out the window. You're doing Twelfth Night. It's not successful. It's a little on one leg, as they say. And you have to make it work, because that baby is going to be in repertory for 9 months. And there's a lot to be said for that, where you learn in front of an audience. And I don't think I got $55 a week plus teaching acting classes. I got to perform in Shaw and Chekhov and Shakespeare, John Whiting. And it was a great, great education.
But you also teaching, you said.
That's when I started teaching. And by the way, I had no idea what I was doing. And that's in the book. I mean, no idea what
I
was
doing. So do you think you ruined a couple of young actors?
No, I think first of all, I got in terrible trouble. I threw out the acting book. I remember the first thing, there was a graph of how to time a laugh. And I went, well, you can't. Can't do this. So I said, let's return this to the bookstore. And we just started talking, and I just had actors get up there and tell me about their lives, and there you are. I mean, that's the seat of acting, to get inside people's... And I told them, I just said, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I know what I do, and let's go here. And I've been doing that for 50 years.
A lot of actors resisted doing television commercials, although now pretty much everybody does. When did you start doing them?
We spat on people who did we actually spat on anybody who did musicals. If it was only Ionesco and Artaud, we were terrible snobs.
So have you ever done a musical?
I did. Yes, it's in the book. I did La Cage aux Folles, and the less said about that, the best. I was the word terrible was invented for what I did. And I'm still, I still feel very badly for what I did.
You write about your first audition for a commercial in a chapter called The 12 Most Embarrassing Moments of My Career.
It used to be 13, but I cut out one because it was so embarrassing. My first, I don't know which one that you're talking about, but I, the one, is it about Bounce?
The waiter, reading for the waiter.
I read for the waiter, and she, I went in and I said, I'm reading for the father. And she said, no, no, you're reading for the waiter. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm sorry, I'm reading for the father. And she says, do you know what a casting director is? I went, no. And she said, I'm the casting director, and what I say goes. And by the way, who I cast usually gets on and goes, all right, let's try one. And the line was, I think, more ice. And so I said, more ice? And she went, Jeffrey, it's two words. And from that moment on, this audition was ruined because I went, more ice? And she went, well, that sounds stilted. More ice? And then I think 5 minutes into it, I was shouting and screaming like a madman. I got to the door, and I turned to her, and I just had my photos and resumes done. And I turned to her, and I said, would you like a picture and resume? And she said, if you must.
Mm.
That was another 2 days
dismissed.
Of crying. Dismissed. On the F train, back to J. Burrow Hall and my little apartment in Brooklyn.
So much film is done these days in the New York area, especially in Brooklyn.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh.
Isn't it?
I don't know. Atlanta and
Brooklyn.
That's true. Baton Rouge.
And less in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about. They seem to. By the way, I did do a piece of work, and I did see. I lived on Dean Street, and apparently, a lot of famous people lived on Dean Street. Jonathan Lethem lived on.
He
Dean
wrote a
Street.
Book about it.
Yeah, he did. Was it called Dean Street?
No, but now I'm trying to remember what it was called. But it's about growing up on Dean Street.
Yeah, and now it's very Tony and very.
It's called something Brooklyn. What was it called?
Oh, Fortitude.
No, that's his.
I love the
comic
way you schluff me off when I'm wrong. It's so, I feel like I'm home. I just love it.
It's a Jewish thing.
It is. Are you Jewish?
Huh?
Lopate?
Yeah, it's Russian, Lopata.
Oh, Lopata. From where? What part of Russia?
My grandfather came from St. Petersburg
in
the 19th century.
My peeps are from Kiev.
Ukrainians.
Ukrainians.
Was being cast in your first Broadway play your big break? That was with George C. Scott?
George C. Scott. I had three lines. Arthur Penn. This was – I was told not to do it because I was also understudy. And I could actually name his famous actor who's – I won't do it – who said, don't do this. You'll be an understudy all your life. But you can't turn down George C. Scott, Gretchen Weiler, Jack Guilford, Hector Elizondo. The list goes on.
Wow, what a cast.
And then – I took over after the great Hector Elizondo left. Hmm. Yeah.
By the way, the book is Motherless Brooklyn, Jonathan Lethem.
Where'd that come from?
I have a crack staff here. They tell me things. So and then also you did Sly Fox on Broadway.
Right, with George.
And then, as you mentioned earlier, Justice for All with Al Pacino.
Right.
Then we wind up with Hank Hay, now Kingsley, on Larry Sanders' Show. How did you meet Gary Shandling?
I was at an audition, and this, and I'm going to forget his name. And I just forgot his name. His name is Alan, and
Zweibel?
Zweibel, thank you. Very well. Alan Zweibel. Sorry, Alan. And
he's been a guest on our show.
Okay. Let me tell my story, Leonard. And he's a wonderful man. And what we were doing wasn't working, and nor did I really want to do it. And he said, may I call somebody? And may I call my friend? And he called Gary and said, I have the guy for you. And a week later, I was in Gary's. So that phone call changed my life. There's just no doubt about it.
And you're playing the sidekick there.
Mm-hmm.
And also a troubled person. Which allowed you to show off your acting.
All my characters are troubled people. I loved Hank. You know, people call him a troubled person and a buffoon, and I just thought he was great. He's a little sensitive, as am I. I understand. You know, there's a half a dozen times in a career you go, I know this guy, and I know Hay now, and I just had the picture of this guy who loved to go to work. I'm sure there's not a book in his house in Malibu. There's just this cold furniture. The television is on in every room. And that guy is so lonely. And
he's slightly clueless.
I don't know if he's clueless. See, I don't know. I think he probably knows French. but he's just lonely.
Do you think that the Larry Sanders Show set the stage for shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and The Office?
Well, I've been told by people that it has, and I've been told by innumerable authors that they have written spec scripts for the Larry Sanders Show. Gary was a forerunner, and he was fearless. Yeah.
Let's talk about Arrested Development. It's hard to imagine the Bluth family without their patriarch, George Bluth Sr. But you write, I wasn't even supposed to be in the thing. How did you go from being a day player to the show's star?
Well, I was actually, as I say in the book, I was actually signed up to be in a pilot that was about dentists. And dentists are not the funniest people in the world. My dentist actually is Dr. Ford. Hi, Dr. Ford. And I'm flossing. I was doing a scene with Jason Bateman, and I remember thinking, oh, this is so – I want to do this. And fortune fell that the dentist show didn't get picked up, and Mitch said, come on, would you? And they said – they phoned me. I was in Prague doing Hellboy, and they said, we're doing 13. How many do you want to be in? I said, oh, 13.
Was it difficult to keep yourself from laughing during some of those bits, like when you were doing the chicken dance to humiliate your son, or when you dressed up as a member of the Blue Man Group to avoid being caught by the police?
First of all, when you're dressed up as the Blue Man Group, you want to kill yourself. That's one, because there's blue coming out of every orifice for months. The second of all is I have a terrible fear of breaking up, because I remember once in repertory theater we broke up, and I remember I almost got fired, and I'm very afraid of it. But I remember with Jason Bateman, it's one of the biggest compliments, and I love Jason. We were doing a scene, and I was in prison, and he kept looking at – he wouldn't look me in the eyes as I was talking to him. He looked in my forehead, and I went, oh, there's something terribly wrong with this actor. A good actor, but he's looking at my forehead. And he later told me he was trying not to laugh, and I thought that was so
that's nice. The way he did it.
Yeah.
Now, there was a season four of Arrested Development.
By the way, since he's lowered his eyes, I just want to correct that.
Arrested Development was on Netflix in 2013. Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll ever be a season five?
Well, I'm not supposed to say anything, but what am I doing right now?
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to hear.
But you didn't say what I was doing.
You're nodding your head yes.
I am not.
You won an Emmy and a Golden Globe for your role as Maura Pfefferman. I have a problem with that name.
Why?
I don't know.
You don't like Maura?
What is it like to play a character who has shocked her family by coming out as transgender at the age of 70?
Yeah. It's I've said it too many times, but it's the truth. Jill Soloway gave me the role of my lifetime. I thought it was going to be Lear, but it's Maura or Mara.
Maura.
If you want to
Maura
talk
I'm
to
sorry.
Maura is fine. Or Mara, which is your show. And it also gave me the responsibility of a lifetime.
But you say Maura is inspired by your father in some ways?
I did.
Well?
No, it's Jill's parent.
By her father.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Carrie.
Yeah.
By her parent, and who is transgender, and the great Carrie, who's the inspiration for Maura.
Do you have to do research to play a role like that?
You do, and you do, and you do, and you do, and you do, but you continue. The fail-safe in playing Maura is, as Jeffrey is learning how to play Maura, Maura's learning how to play Maura. And that's the fail-safe. Mm. But I tell you, and we're four seasons in, my hands still shake.
Were you aware of the issues that transgender people face before you started working on the show?
I thought I was. I thought I was. I knew nothing. And I grew up in San Francisco in the theatrical community. I thought I was, but no. And I'm still learning, and it's a very interesting world. And it's a gift. It's a gift. I mean, James Barton Hill was right.
You never know who's listening. Susan Merson called.
Susan Merson?
Yeah, she says she's been applauding you for years, since the days when she ushered at the Hillbury at Wayne State University, and you were acting. She was 13 at the time.
Well, that doesn't make me feel old at all.
And now she's an actress herself, inspired by you to some degree.
Wow. A 13-year-old usher at Wayne State University. You see, you never know. That's a very interesting thing. And you, hi, Susan. I congratulate you. I'm all about, you know, when parents come to me, oh, my son or my daughter's going to become an actor, I just let them go. It's the best education in the world. It is so, and again, hi, Susan. Well done. Well done.
Do people ever assume that you're like the characters you play?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They think you are. Somebody once... they'd only seen Hank, and we were at a dinner party, and they actually turned to me and says, "You're intelligent." And I went, "Well, yeah, that's all." I have things said to me. I recently had somebody say, "I like some of your work." Why would somebody say
some of your work?
I like some of your work. That's where you stop on the street and go, "What the hey?" And I have to tell you, the revolution is not over. You know, I do Twitter and tweet and all that stuff just for public relations reasons and everything like that. There is still the odd comment that will just floor you and just say, somebody tweeted me the other day and saying, how can you possibly allow your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren to see this? So we're not done yet.
Well, you still only have young children. You adopted young children at the age of 72.
Yeah. But so, we also
we do have an older one.
One of them. We have an older one, and we have two.
Jeffrey Tambor will be speaking with Jude Flight tonight at the 92nd Street Y at 7:30. For ticket information, go to our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. The book, Are You Anybody?, published by Crown Archetype. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed this.